You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. From the introduction to Supernatural Horror in Literature, an essay by H.P. Lovecraft. In the fiction of Lovecraft, there are people who are not what they seem. Sometimes they look normal on the outside, but secretly are monsters on the inside. Sometimes they're monstrous on the outside, but have an inner life of profound poetic beauty. His writing provides a strange mixture of the macabre, the poetic, and the noxious. And as we'll soon learn, the same can be said of H.P. Lovecraft himself.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today, we welcome back author and researcher Scott Poole. Scott previously joined us to talk about monsters in America, and again to talk about the life of TV monster host Vampyra. In his latest book, he tackles the complex subject of H.P. Lovecraft. Regular listeners will know that I'm a fan of Lovecraft's fiction. We've had two previous episodes that discussed Lovecraftian topics. Our episode on Cthulhu still remains in the top 10 most downloaded episodes. And our crossover episode with the Lovecraft geek, who is Lovecraft scholar Bob Price, is also a very popular episode. Poole's new biography is called In the Mountains of Madness, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of H.P. Lovecraft. And a link to his book will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. There are several biographies of Lovecraft out there, perhaps S.T. Joshi's two-volume edition of H.P. Lovecraft, A Life, I guess could be described as the most encyclopedic reference volume for biographical material on the author, but I think Poole's work's a very accessible and detailed take on what's certainly a complicated story. If you're unfamiliar with Lovecraft's writing, it can be a daunting, challenging task to take on. But if you're a fan of his work, you may find that learning about the writer is itself a daunting task. Poole does an excellent job of throwing light on the entire quivering mass of Lovecraft's body as it lies there on the threshold of the library. He doesn't shy away from the disgusting bits, and he doesn't lose sight of the simple truth that every real person is a complex mixture of good and bad, and Lovecraft is definitely no exception. But why is Lovecraft important enough to get a special episode? Because he has influenced American horror in immeasurable ways. A recurring theme on Monster Talk is our discussion of where did that idea come from? Lovecraft's fiction has inspired millions of people to take up pens and write. Some have written direct copies of his style, and others have taken bits of influence from here and there, and Lovecraft himself was synthesizing elements from yet other writers, and perhaps his greatest mark on the world is not the words he himself wrote, but the millions of words he inspired. That remains to be seen. But his influence on writers like Robert Bloch, Stephen King, Ramsey Campbell, and films like The Evil Dead, John Carpenter's The Thing, the TV show Stranger Things, heavy metal bands including Black Sabbath, role-playing games and board games, and more video games that I can even begin to name. This is a kind of creeping, tentacular cultural aura of influence that's eerily appropriate considering the nature of the old man's writing. Scott Poole dared to pick up his flashlight and to go down those stairs. Let's hear what he discovered as he joins us for some
Monster Talk.
All right, welcome back, Scott, for your third visit to Monster Talk.
Yeah, sounds good.
You're basically up there with like Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin. It's great.
Right, just drop the initials, you know, when I'm actually.
Yeah.
All right. And today we're here to talk about your book, In the Mountains of Madness, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of H.P. Lovecraft. And this is one of our special literary episodes where we're not really talking about skepticism, but we will be talking about some monsters and some monstrous aspects to this great American writer.
Absolutely. And some skepticism, probably.
All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners, Rick Duffy, for his input with this show, too. He just gave me a couple of questions that he would like answered during the course of this episode. So, well, let's get started then. To begin with, Scott, how did you become interested in H.P. Lovecraft and what inspired you to write a biography about him?
So in one way or another, I've been interested in Lovecraft for a good 3 decades. I actually first encountered him in high school in an anthology that was put together by Marvin Cooper of Weird Tales Writers. It wasn't a particularly good anthology. It was made up of mostly sort of lesser Weird Tales writers, but there was one Lovecraft story, which I think tells you a little something about how his popularity has grown just over, you know, that time period. And then in the 1990s, when the Penguin editions that S.D. Joshi edited and annotated heavily became available, and really for the first time, we were all sort of able to read Lovecraft as Lovecraft wanted to be read. That was kind of my reintroduction, fascination, and obsession. I didn't really write about Lovecraft until about 2009, 2010. There's a couple of sections in Monsters in America that deal with him. And then subsequently, I'd written a few articles and essays. And it seemed, right in the book, after Vampyra, it actually seemed a kind of a natural progression. From, you know, looking at the monster tradition more broadly and the horror tradition more broadly in American history, then focusing in on a Vampyra, who obviously is a not particularly well-known cult figure, but, you know, I think very important to kind of the emergence of she's sort of the grassroots of horror. And so it made a lot of sense to me to then go back and look at what in the 20th century anyway is to me really the origins of much of the contemporary, not all of, but much of the contemporary horror tradition thought of very broadly, fiction, film, but also horror culture and fan culture.
Okay.
So I was almost, so in a way, like, you know, after kind of a lifelong interest in Lovecraft, I think in writing the book, and this I think is the one of the ways it's different from a standard biography, is that it is about Lovecraft as a phenomenon as much as it is about Lovecraft as a person, although it's really about both.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was going to mention that. I really enjoyed the book, and I thought you did a really good job of not only covering the events of his life, but also contextualizing what's happened to him after his death, which is in many ways even more interesting because I guess that's what most of us encounter in our lives as if we get into his material. But I want to talk about some of his biographical elements. When we talk about his childhood, or like we think about how I noticed in the book you took special effort to defend his mother. Can you talk a little bit about his peculiar youth and how his relationship with his mother and his aunts have been, how you felt about him and how they've been dealt with in other biographical material?
So, it's interesting. That's an interesting question because I've probably taken more criticism other than one other part of the book that we might talk about later. I've taken more criticism for the reexamination of Sarah Susan Lovecraft, his mother, than any other aspect of the book. And I actually didn't see myself as defending her, although I think in the end, because I had to engage with some of what had been written about her subsequently, I ended up having to defend her in a sense in the text. But I just uncovered a lot of interesting material that suggested to me that other interpreters of Lovecraft, going back to the 1970s, in some ways going back to his sort of first interpreters, August Derleth, in the 1940s and 1950s, that they had really worked pretty assiduously to create a picture of her in which she was the grasping mother who was responsible for his early reclusive tendencies, responsible for him essentially dropping out of law school, responsible for him not attending Brown University, which he later claimed that he did, but he never did, in some of his correspondence. And I found that that just actually did not represent the nature of their relationship, just from what I learned about her from essentially the world's largest H.P. Lovecraft collection at the John Hay Library at Brown. What I found instead was a woman who certainly was considered odd for her time, but I mean, in a way, that's a sort of a compliment to be considered an odd woman at the turn of the turn of the century, especially in upper class Providence. And also a woman who was very interested in supplying H.P. Lovecraft with anything that he needed to pursue any interest that he ever had, whether that was in literature or his interest in chemistry or his interest in astronomy. She made certain that he was able to do that. And there's a sense in which I think that, you know, she created H.P. Lovecraft instead of the way she's often been presented, which is, to be frank, that she sort of needed to die before he could then blossom. And one of the things that struck me about that is that that's such a common narrative with male artists, that they're being held back by grasping females in various ways. And then when they like break out of that cocoon, then like, you know, suddenly, you know, they blossom into a beautiful literary butterfly. And I was seeing sort of the same thing in the portrayal of his mother. And sometimes it got pretty rough. There was actually a biography in the 1970s that has a chapter called "The Monster Mother," describing her. And you know, just looking at it as a historian, I found that representation was based on hearsay, flimsy evidence, missing evidence, evidence we don't have. A lot of authors, biographers, and interpreters quoting one another. So that's the basis of my reevaluation of her. Although if you go on Reddit, it's because I'm a social justice warrior.
Ah, well, there's always that.
which I actually thought. This is how uncool I'm getting in my old age. I actually, when I first somebody called me that on Twitter, I actually thought it was like a compliment. I was like, oh, wow, a social I'm like Frederick Douglass or something, you know, and turns out it's a bad thing.
It's intended to be a pejorative, whether one chooses to take it as I think one's own choice, right?
We could be considered social justice warriors too, so you're in good company.
Exactly. Of course, SJW is the
sure. Person. And I also think that the fact that term also, the last word also sounds like worrier. Always,
right?
The punter in me is always amused by that. No matter what the evil intent of the person throwing it, it's like, that's funny. What?
Yeah, we are worried about social justice.
Anyway,
Scott, you mentioned Brown University. Could you tell us a little bit about Lovecraft's education and what prepared him to be a writer?
Well, you know, he had actually very little preparation in certain respects for his writerly career. He was a voracious reader, if we are to believe his own account and the account of others, and I tend to do so. He was actually reading Edgar Allan Poe in the late 1890s. And so, you know, he would have been 8, 9, 10 years old. He was reading Scheherazade and The Thousand and One Nights. He was poring over Greek mythology. He may or may not have come in contact with the stories of Ambrose Bierce at an early age, the Civil War veteran who becomes a supernatural writer in the 1880s, 1890s. He definitely had read him by 1919. And he did actually write, we don't have the manuscripts for all of them, but he did actually write some essentially juvenilia stories that are partially suspense, partially supernatural, partially detective tales, really kind of imitations of Poe. But then he was also reading just enormous amounts of pulp magazines, these turn of the century magazines printed on cheap paper that dealt with what we would think of as a variety of different genres, although the term wasn't common at that time. He would have been reading detective stories, adventure stories, Old West stories, even romance, in fact. He had a really, really diverse set of literary influences, along with his deep interest in science. Again, particularly astronomy. At one point, before his education faltered, he thought that he was going to be a astronomer and sort of aspired to that. And these things actually come together in interesting ways, I think, in his fiction. His interest in what he called the infinite spaces, the void, that's really sort of comes from his fascination with astronomy. And then his interest in all things supernatural, certainly from a little bit of Poe, although as I talk about in the book, I don't think that Poe ultimately influences him as a writer as much as some have claimed, but also from Thousand and One Nights and Greek mythology and other issues.
We've got a lot of questions about Lovecraft prepared for this interview, but there's one that's kind of a meta issue that I want to ask you about.
Oh, I love meta issues.
So Lovecraft is this interesting character, but like a lot of writers, he himself is a very complicated fellow who's got some things about his life that once you dig into it are really troubling, I think, for a person in modern times, at least. I think especially if we're going to be social justice warriors, he is really troubled. He's a troubling character. So how does a teacher and a writer deal with this historically significant figure in a field whose views on these issues are somehow, they're sometimes so reprehensible, yet whose body of work is so influential? I mean, how do you handle that?
So I think I can actually even do you one better in the sense, in terms of how problematic it is, in the sense that it's not just his personal attitudes or personal prejudices. Obviously, we encounter that with many writers of the past, many writers of the present, I would add. And, that's simply very common. I think that one of the things that makes Lovecraft different, and some of his apologists have resisted this idea, but one of the things that makes Lovecraft different is that his hatred of immigrants, his very strange, and we can talk more about why it's so strange, anti-Semitism, his really just utter hatred of Black Americans, that actually became a part of his writing in some of his most famous tales. The Call of Cthulhu is the best, worst example of that. It's peoples that he considered, in his word, degenerate, or primitive, who first hear the Call of Cthulhu, who are most responsive to this ancient elder god who is going to wipe out the human race. And the horror at Red Hook Another one of his tales from the mid-1920s does something very similar. So he's problematic really not just in his individual prejudices, but also it invades his body of work. It's part of his body of work. So I think, you know, as a writer and a teacher, you do two things. First, I suppose it's something you don't do, and that you don't try to defend it or separate it out from the body of work, or go at it as if, well, we're just going to mine the material for the things that we are comfortable with, and sort of write off the rest as a product of the times. That's the favorite thing to do with many of his most ardent apologists who don't want to talk about this topic. Right. Just say, okay, well, everybody was racist in the 19-teens, 20s, and 1930s, which, as the book makes clear, is not the case at all, was not even the case in Lovecraft's circle of friends. So you don't do that. What you do is you use that material, I think, to think about the broader historical context in which we're not talking just about the prejudices of one individual, as deep-rooted and sometimes as pathological as they were, but we're also talking about a system, a whole system of historical racial oppression that was part of the 1920s and the 1930s, and I also always like to make the point, has not completely disappeared. This is one of my problems with the product of his times argument. When you say that, it's as if, well, you know, all of that was just in the past and now it's gone.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I think that we have plenty of contemporary evidence that that's simply not the case.
I call them family reunions. No.
Yeah, other people call them Thanksgiving.
Yeah, exactly.
But yes. So I think that the thing that has been that was most strange for me in writing the book, and then particularly when it was first released and was being reviewed and commented on a good bit, I think the strangest thing to me was the absolute insistence that we really not deal openly with this particular issue, even though there are ways in which we can analyze it in such a way that I think that we can both understand him better, his work better, the times he lived in, and the times we live in now better, if we look at it that way. I mean, I think some of Lovecraft's defenders have, on this point, have made some good points. S.T. Joshi says, for example, who of course is, you know, sort of the foremost authority on Lovecraft and wrote a 2-volume, 1,000-page biography, he makes the point that, you know, Bram Stoker, for example, held, very reactionary attitudes on race. John W. Campbell of Amazing Stories held, you know, not only reactionary attitudes, but was very involved in the far right and at mid-century and was an opponent of the civil rights movement. Both of these figures have awards named for them, you know, are recognized as sort of giants in the field of horror and of fantasy. I think that we shouldn't separate Lovecraft out from that.
And yet, his wife was Jewish, wasn't she? And he had friends who were Jewish.
That's exactly right, and I think that that is also part of what complicates the story. So, you know, in 1924, he marries Sonia Haft Green, who was a Jewish woman from Ukraine. An editor, an author, and actually an independent entrepreneur, kind of almost sort of a typical 1920s new woman, as they called those types of figures at the time. Their marriage was short-lived, And they essentially separated. They married in 24. They essentially separated in 1926. Sonia thought that they had divorced in 1929, but Lovecraft actually never signed the papers. And so technically they were still married when she remarried later. Lovecraft himself didn't want a divorce from her. And then, you know, he's also close friends and correspondence with Samuel Loveman, who is Jewish, and gay, and a close friend of Hart Crane. You know, he's close friends with James Morton, who in the 1920s, is so dedicated to the earliest African-American freedom struggle that he's publishing pamphlets about the topic. He moves to Harlem. He debates Lovecraft about this issue in letters. So, you know...
And Julius Schwartz was his agent. Julius was Jewish.
No, he didn't quite... So their business relationship comes quite late.
It does
in his life, but you're absolutely right that he was certainly open. He was certainly open to that.
It's I only mentioned it because I got to meet Julius and ask him about it.
Right. Oh, and well, that's interesting. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but I met him at Dragon Con one year when he came. He was one of the guests of honor because of his long work with comics. And I just happened to see him standing around in the lobby. And so I walked up and talked to him for a few minutes. But I said, you know, you're one of the few people I know around who actually, you know, at least corresponded with Lovecraft and worked with him.
Right.
But I was curious, how did it affect things with you being Jewish and him being so anti-Semitic? And he said, I don't know if I can get his words exactly, but it was along the lines of, you know, I had heard that about him, but it never came up.
Yes.
And that was basically the extent of it. They had a very professional relationship. The fact that he was Jewish just never was an issue in any of their work together. So
interesting.
Right. I think that it's been very hard to, although I think it's important to do so, separate out a bit some of the pretty horrific language that, of course, Lovecraft knew how to use in his letters about race from his dealings with individuals, at least when it came to Jews. He, on the other hand, you know, everything that he ever said about African-Americans is nearly unprintable. Except some of it was printed and shows up in his tales. And I think that that makes him a little bit different from, or very different from, writers in the past, who have held similar attitudes, but, it maybe did not infest their stories in such a straightforward way.
I've seen some excerpts from some of his comments about foreigners that he encountered, and the way he described them was almost identical to the way he describes some of the, as you put, degenerate, well, he put it, and you didn't put it that way, you're just repeating what he said, but the the way he talks about these weird, degenerate, you know, races of people, in his fiction.
And his monsters.
Yeah, and in his monsters. All is basically the same way that maybe at the best that he talks about foreigners in his regular correspondence. I mean, it's poetical, but horrible.
Very dehumanizing.
Yeah, well, right.
It's absolutely dehumanizing. And yeah. I think I've actually said before that I think one of the things that hurts Lovecraft the sheer torrent of language that came out of him at all times in his stories and his letters. Mm-hmm. You know, he's definitely was talking about things that he actually believed. Unfortunately, you have the combination of At least in my opinion, this is not everyone's opinion, which is something I talk about in the book. But in my opinion, you have the complication of someone who is both an incredible and extraordinary writer and also a very committed racist who was able to say those things in a almost hyper indulgent type of language and discourse.
You know, his writing, I should say something positive about it because we've we've hammered on it quite a bit about his life and his belief systems. But I mean, there's so much really enjoyable stuff in his work. I have this analogy, and here I'm going to have to throw an explicit tag on the episode about this analogy. But I've described it like, and sometimes it seems like you get stuff like this. It's like there's a poop with some beautiful succulent corn in it, you know. It's like, that corn looks great, but oh, it's stuck in a turd, you know. And I feel bad about that. I mean, some of his work is beautiful, just fine like it is. But some of his work is like that. You can get these really lovely little nuggets out of it, but you're still working out of a turd. So,
well, and I think there's some things about Lovecraft's writing that critics have spoken very unfairly about. He is often accused of having adjectiveitis, just sort of the inability to exclude a long list of adjectives. That's in some of his stories, but not all of them. It is true that he had difficulty writing dialogue or clear characters. many of his protagonists seem to be they're sort of interchangeable and very much like himself. But the thick descriptions of places, the incredible attention to detail when he's describing a place he's visited, or indeed a place he's only read about. Famously, he has one story set in Paris, which, he never crossed the Atlantic. And also his description of, this goes back to what we were saying earlier, just his description of both his moods, or the moods of his characters and his monsters, actually can be hypnotic at times. And that's actually how I think of his writing. It's you have to dive into it and be prepared to dive deep. He's not an author for summer vacation reading. He really is, as I think actually all great writers, he has to be deeply engaged before you really get what is there.
I would throw this in that, like, my wife has just started reading her first Lovecraft story. So she asked me what book. Well, I'll tell you. She asked me what book should I start with, and I said The Dictionary, because that's my running joke on Lovecraft. And she laughed, but she didn't believe me. But I started her with Shadow Over Innsmouth, and she has provided me with a list of like 25 words she had to look up to understand what the hell was going on. It's great. So.
I usually say Shadow over Innsmouth as well, actually.
Yeah. It's a good one to start with. It really is. So,
for the vocabulary.
Right. Well, you can't. Right. Literally every one of his stories is going to have some words in it you don't know. There's just zero chance you're going to hop into this as a modern American and not run into words you've never seen before. Not only that, but I would suspect that was probably true for a lot of the readers back when he was writing the tales.
Even then.
Yeah.
This is absolutely the case, especially when you consider that, Weird Tales magazine from 1923 onward had, from what we can tell, and it's always hard to tell exactly how texts circulate, but from what we can tell, it had a fairly working class, lower middle class audience. They were very demanding stories, although as it turns out, they also were some of the most popular stories in the long run, at least, that Weird Tales ever ever published. There was enormous demand, and, you know, this is sort of understandable in, I think, the nature of fandom, but immediately after his death in 1937, there was enormous demand to reprint a lot of the old stories that, that, you know, may not have been everyone's favorite, you know, at first.
So this is a little bit of a departure from what we've been discussing, but I came across a couple of sources that said that he probably suffered from sleep paralysis. So would you agree with that? And how do you think, if that is the case, how do you think it influenced his writing?
So I've come across that as well. I have not found any, you know, really solid evidence for that. I think that where it comes from is the fact that he did, and you can tell this from his day book and also his correspondence about his own stories, how his stories came about. He seems to have been an incredibly lucid dreamer. And he actually was a person who slept through most of the day and worked at night. And some of his very interesting stories, you can tell this. The Dream of the Unknown Kadath, The Outsider, what are called his Randolph Carter stories, which was sort of a returning character that he had, Silver Key. They're all stories that are in different ways about the sort of fuzzy, ambiguous line between dreaming and waking. There's actually one, it's not so much a story, it's almost a kind of a strange prose poem called Nyarlathotep. And speaking of a word you have to look up and practice pronouncing. But Nyarlathotep, he apparently actually began writing it in a state between waking and sleep. He actually tells a story of waking up with a pen in hand. He always wrote with a pen, or not always, but he hated typewriters and only typed a few stories in his life. And he actually woke up, you know, writing this tale out. You know, he's sort of in the middle of the first paragraph. So I don't know if we could ever really, you know, make a hard and fast claim that, you know, he suffered from sleep paralysis. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that that was the case, because he seems to have had, and his characters have in turn, an incredibly interesting dream life that finds its way into his stories and are responsible for many of his stories. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of envious of his dream life. I occasionally have dreams I remember, but almost always don't. And when I do remember them, they're so mundane, it's sad. It's
well, like, same here.
Brain dumps.
I actually have felt the same sort of envy, because he, you know, and some of this, of course, we're extrapolating from his fiction, which obviously he was adding elements to. But I mean, he does seem to have been able to control his dreams to some degree. He wasn't a writer, and this shows in many of his tales. Probably the major criticism I would have of him as a writer is he simply did not want to revise. And I think part of that is that, you know, he was recording dream experiences in some cases. And his correspondent friends are kind of constantly, you know, urging him to, you know, rewrite this, change this around, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he had very little interest in that.
I can understand that.
Yeah. If people are making, he's one of those people who in American letters that people love to speculate on, you know, was he racist? Well, yeah. But was he gay? Was something wrong with him? You know, that, you know, did he really believe in these magical things he was talking about? This sort of stuff. A lot of these things can be, you know, quickly resolved if you actually go back and look at the source of the rumors or whatever, but some are more problematic or intriguing. I'm thinking here, though, about he reminds me of someone with Asperger's syndrome. I wouldn't want to – I hate the whole idea of diagnosing people, but he was an early precocious reader, and he seemed very monomaniacal about a lot of the topics he liked. I don't know. A lot of it sounds like that, and that's not meant as a diagnosis or anything. I just have a lot of experience with Aspies in my real life and love uh-huh. many of them, but it seems very familiar to me, that part of his life. So,
hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, I think one of the things I hope comes out in the book, though, is that although a writer that I think he's comparable to in certain ways not, but a writer he's comparable to is Kafka. And one of the ways in which he's a bit like Kafka is he actually went through these long periods of almost complete seclusion, followed by, an almost like exhilarating, like, you know, bursting out into the world and traveling as much as his limited budget allowed and visiting, you know, people who were on his correspondence list, his long correspondence list. And I think even his marriage and brief move from Providence, which he loved, to Brooklyn, although in the end he ends up hating and despising New York City and moving back and I am Providence and all that kind of stuff. The very fact that he did that is in some ways very, very shocking in comparison to what we know about his pretty reclusive youth. So it almost
sounds a little bit like bipolarism.
Perhaps.
Like another diagnosis thing.
Obviously, I hope it also comes out in the book that you know, I'm very wary of psychoanalyzing him in part just because as a historian, you know, we're warned from the beginnings of graduate school on never to do that.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. It's speculation, and it's probably inevitable to be wrong at the worst.
Unfair.
And unprovable no matter what, you know.
So. Right. Interesting to talk about.
it is interesting, though. I think I understand the impulse because, you know, it would be easy to go through the DSM and find a lot of things that Lovecraft seems to match up with just in his personality, because there's no doubt he's an eccentric and of the highest order. And And so, but, you know, I think that's part of what makes him complicated and interesting.
But consciously, it seems like it's an affectation that he would, you know, call himself an old. Yeah, so. Good point. Some of it, right. So.
He definitely, though, created, you know, different personas at different times. And I think also one of the things I like about Lovecraft is that he was very open about the fact that he was doing that. This even actually goes to some of his political and cultural beliefs. I quote him at one point in the book, essentially saying that, he realized that many of his political, social, cultural ideas were ultimately illusions that he used to kind of keep himself safe from, you know, the cosmic dread that he believed in. It was sort of what kept him from being a full-on nihilist in many ways, to hold on to these traditions that he thought were ultimately illusory.
And you mentioned a little bit about his correspondence, and it seems like Lovecraft had a large network of correspondence over the years. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly, I'd be happy to talk a bit about it. So we actually don't have anywhere close to all of the letters that he wrote. I believe it's S.T. Joshi who suggests that he wrote perhaps as many as 100,000 letters in his life. And then, unfortunately, he did not save letters back to him. So we don't have that. But Arkham House Publishers, August Derleth's outfit, published numerous volumes of his correspondence stretching from the 1910s until his death in 1937. There were some people in his life that he wrote to every single day, often letters that ran to 30, 40 pages in his very cramped writing hand. We also, unfortunately, this would certainly be the mother lode for Lovecraft scholars, we unfortunately don't have any of the letters between Lovecraft and his wife. She apparently burned all of his at one point. And again, he never saved letters anyway. I mentioned in the book, he almost creates a kind of an early fan network. It's a little bit like, a Reddit forum or one of the old original internet fandom forums, in the way that he and other aficionados of the weird tale genre were circulating letters to one another on all kinds of topics, not just horror and fantasy, but architecture, which was one of his passions, astronomy, all of the sciences, his criticisms of religion, his criticisms of metaphysics in general, what they're reading, the books that they're loaning to each other, and then talking about the books they're loaning to each other. So there's a strange way in which he always maintained a very lively social existence, even when he was spending a lot of time at home in Providence.
It's interesting to me, because coming from what seemed to be an almost sequestered form of childhood, he and with his fascination with the 1700s, it seems like he almost tried to make himself into a pamphleteer before he found out about these other networks of writing, writing his little papers on astronomy and sharing them as newsletter. It's so neat, because I feel like he in some ways would fit in so well with modernity, even though he hates modernity,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I actually have a sneaking suspicion that although he would have told everyone that he despised it, I have a sneaking suspicion he would have loved Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
that he would have loved Twitter. Yeah. I think he would have loved Instagram, in fact. But at the same time, yes, he could, at least one of his personas was ultimate enemy of modernity, the mechanical civilization is invading, you know, the old good old ways of the 18th century, which happened to be, you know, his personal golden age. And yet, yes, I totally agree. I think that I think he would have loved the speed of communication and email and, and internet forums.
Oh, Lovecraft on Twitter is a funny idea.
It really is. I don't know. Unfortunately, with his vocabulary, I think Twitter might be a problem.
Only 140 characters.
Right. Yeah, he's definitely somebody who would write long threads, I think.
Right.
The 140 word character limitation would probably have driven him mad.
And then he would have fainted, as he does.
That's right.
I was thinking about the there's been this long-running thing where fans of Lovecraft want to believe that some of the things he constructs in his stories are true, and I was thinking about the fact that he writes stories where he explicitly in his real life disagrees with the premises being carried out in his stories, which I think is kind of fun. You can find clear evidence that he doesn't believe in the stuff he's writing just by looking outside his stories. And one of them has to do with the fact that many of the plots of his stories have to do with consciousness leaving the human body and moving to another body. And right. If you go to Reanimator, Herbert West Reanimator, he's sure. constantly talking about how, oh, you've got to hurry because if the brain gets damaged, well, then the person's personality is damaged, right? So he knows.
Right.
He knows that everything is the brain. And by the time you get to Whisper in the Darkness, you've got him talking about, no, we just pull the brain out. You know, we
the brains in jars story.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, he sort of remained this kind of odd kind of materialist, even in, you know, as he's writing these stories that involve occult grimoire and ancient gods. And, you know, I think that's part of the thing that has made his work continue to remain popular. In that there are obviously stories, The Color Out of the Space, The Color of Space, At the Mountains of Madness, that really are what we would think of as science fiction horror, and so that's why he, you know, obviously has been so influential on things like, you know, the original Alien, the 1979 Alien, and. I think in general horror film since the 1960s, particularly in the work of John Carpenter, you know, you see Lovecraft again and again, and it's because he partially because at least he skirts that line between an interest in the supernatural and his own historical and physical materialism. It is true that, you know, almost every couple of years there's a book that appears claiming that that Lovecraft, you know, was channeling some sort of mystical forces, that he met Aleister Crowley, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there's a mountain of evidence that Lovecraft was not only an atheist, but a lifelong militant atheist who believed that matter was all that there was, that the basic question was, you know, is there such a thing as spirit? And his answer was, well, we don't have any empirical evidence for that. So, no.
Right. But he did like to fawn over the Greeks.
He did. Oh, yeah, he absolutely did. I think there actually is something in that, too, you know, in that and then in his later interest in horror, in that I think that in a way his materialism kind of set his imagination free, his belief that sort of the imaginary life was the only life where you would experience the realms of the fantastic. And so that became a big playground to him in a way that, you know, it never would have if, you know, he actually believed in, you know, actually held to occult beliefs God, that's unimaginable. I mean, like, he just would have been writing these very serious tomes, you know, filled with unpronounceable names and mixing up Hermeticism and Kabbalah and all the other things that early 20th century occultists were doing. And it would be pretty dire reading.
So, Scott, you've mentioned that a lot of Lovecraft's personal correspondence has been lost to us, but how was his creative writing preserved after he died?
It's a interesting, complicated story. I'll give you the sort of the short version. He really wanted his heir, his literary heir, to be his young friend Robert Barlow. That is who. In a written statement and a written message, he wanted to be his literary executor. Barlow, because of a variety of reasons, distance, age, not exactly sure, I think, at first how to proceed in actually being a literary executor for Lovecraft, really kind of loses this position to another one of Lovecraft's admirers, August Derleth, who begins Arkham House Publishers in the late 1930s. And really, its only purpose was to publish Lovecraft's work. And Derleth is interesting, plays an important part in my story, plays an important part in the story of everyone who's written about Lovecraft, because he exercised an enormous amount of influence over the Lovecraft legacy. Really up until the time of his death in late 60s, early 70s. Derleth is an interesting character. He's a problematic character in many ways because he preserves Lovecraft, but at the same time, he actually corrupted significant parts of Lovecraft's work and manuscripts. And for a number of decades, I mentioned those Penguin editions in the 1990s. A little bit shockingly, that's actually the first time that we were really able to read Lovecraft as Lovecraft wanted to be read. Before, we were reading heavily edited materials from Derleth, as well as what he called, I've always loved this phrase, he called them posthumous collaborations.
nice.
Speaking of the occult, by which he basically meant he found a story idea in Lovecraft's day book and ran with it and wrote it and sold it, published it and sold it as, you know, a collaboration between himself and H.P. Lovecraft. So even in the 60s, when some of these great, beautifully designed, hippy-dippy designed colors, covers of Lovecraft's work begins to come out from Ballantine and others, some of it is Lovecraft, some of it is Derleth, some of it is both of them. Some have said, and I think I tend to agree with this, that some of the early critical rejection of Lovecraft comes from the fact that the critics weren't actually reading Lovecraft. They were reading imitators, pastiche of Lovecraft tales, Lovecraft tales that had been very, very heavily edited. This is actually another way in which his work is a bit similar to, or rather his experience was a bit similar to Kafka's.
A lot of your book is on the weird second life of Lovecraft, or his material at least. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. So, you know, I would say probably more than half of the book is about the Lovecraft phenomena. And one of the things that has interested me about him is that There are actually more, and I will explain this odd statement, there are more Lovecraft fans than people who have actually read Lovecraft.
Oh, that's got to be true. Yeah, yeah.
I've met and talked with a number of them, and I talk about some of the experiences with that in the book, where there's a pretty substantial number of millennial fans of Lovecraft who have really scant knowledge of the actual stories. They may have read The Call of Cthulhu. They may have read The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And then they may have read a book or two about him. But that's really about it. What they're really into are the films, either direct adaptations or heavily influenced by Lovecraft and kind of the Lovecraftian worldview of cosmic horror. And then also very important, particularly actually since the 80s, have been the tabletop role-playing games, Sandy Peterson's Call of Cthulhu series, and then in the last few years, just actually an explosion of these really very quite complicated Lovecraft-based board games that are really role-playing games themselves. That combined with a couple of appearances in video games. There was an Xbox game a number of years ago called Call of Cthulhu. There's another one that was announced at E3 actually this summer that's going to be out on consoles and on PCs in the fall. And then just sort of his shadow, I think, as a writer that if you understand him, you understand sort of the deepest levels of the nature of horror fiction. And so a kind of a fandom has built up around that. But again, there's a somewhat ambiguous line between that really dedicated fandom in many ways and people who have actually read all of his tales, which is fairly easy to do. I mean, there's three short Penguin volumes of his work. He wasn't an incredible of short stories. He wasn't an incredibly prolific writer. But as we talked about earlier, he's not an easy writer. he's not even close. It's work. And some fans seem to have been able to, you know, go to that level and really get into his writing and understand how it can affect you on a number of different levels. Others just seem to be perfectly happy, you know, playing around in the world of Lovecraft with the films and the video games and the RPGs.
And just for clarification, he was not an easy writer, and easy writer is not a Lovecraft film. Just wanted to clarify
that. That's exactly right.
It's not?
Although
there are some hallucinatory aspects of easy writer are a little bit Lovecrafty.
That scene in the cemetery, yeah.
Right.
So we've got one final question, and sure. So we've had you on the show before and asked you who your favorite monster is, and from memory it was Bride of Frankenstein?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. So we thought we'd do a slightly different take on the question and to ask you which is your favorite Lovecraft story or which are your favorite Lovecraft stories?
Oh, absolutely. I actually have a real affection for some of the early tales of Lovecraft, the kind of pre-Call of Cthulhu tales. I suppose if I was pinned down to one story, I would say it actually is one of the later tales, the 1931 Shadow Over Innsmouth. But some of the early stories like Dagon, The Tomb... there's a story I'm particularly fond of from the early 1920s that's been unfortunately generally ignored, but I think is going to make a comeback, called Hypnos, that is very interesting and very strange and actually presages some of the things that he writes about in his more famous post-1926 period.
Neat. Okay. I'm a big fan of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, and...
they're actually excellent. Yeah,
and I was gonna. I'll refer the listeners to that if they want to check that out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But the cool thing about it is they went through every Lovecraft story, and then including the collaborations. But then they've gone out and gone into the stories that were mentioned in his the supernatural horror and literature.
Yeah, the essay that deals with sort of the progression of writing about the supernatural.
Exactly. And it's a great essay, and he's got so many references. And now they're going through the works that he referenced in that work.
Arthur Macken and
exactly Dunsany and lots of others. I can't remember his name. I'm terrible with names. I'm terrible with many things. It's just so. Let me do this. Let me say we'll probably have to wind up here. And say. We'll do our little outro thing. So I'm going to say thank you so much for joining us again, Scott. We really appreciate you talking about
this
writer.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. I enjoyed doing it again. I always like to talk to you guys about this stuff. So thank you.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with author Scott Poole about his new biography of H.P. Lovecraft titled In the Mountains of Madness. A link to Scott's book will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. While preparing our interview, Scott and I got into a little debate about a particular short story written by Stephen King and whether or not that story was a Lovecraft pastiche. It's a fun discussion, or at least I think so, but I didn't include it in the main interview, and if you'd like to hear it, it is after the credits of this episode. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like to find the opinions of Skeptic Magazine, you could make your way to the dusty shelves of Miskatonic University Library. Head back to the special collections and look for a particular book. Though, come to think of it, ever since that odd incident with that peculiar fellow Wilbur Whately, they've been very reluctant to let strangers in, so maybe it would be easier to just go to your local newsstand and ask for a copy of Skeptic Magazine or to try out eSkeptic, the free weekly newsletter. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Thanks again for all your support, especially for the books. Karen and I have quite a lot of research material now, and sometimes Amazon doesn't include your names or contact information so we can thank you personally, but we appreciate all of your donations immensely. Thank you again for your Patreon support. Because of you, I'm able to attend Crypticon in September in Kentucky, where I'll be giving a talk about science and monsters. Here's a little more info about that convention.
Attention all listeners. We are hearing reports from all over Kentucky that something big is happening. Strange creatures have been seen roaming the hills, goblins emerging from caves. A goat man was spotted near a train trestle. There have even been sightings of an 8-foot-tall humanoid creature covered in hair. What's going on in the Bluegrass State? To find out, you will need to go to CryptidCon, Bigfoot Monsters and Legends. Head on over to Frankfort, Kentucky, September 9th and 10th. At CryptidCon, you will meet Cliff and Bobo from Finding Bigfoot, Nick Groff from Paranormal Lockdown and Ghosts of Shepherdstown. You'll learn from top researchers in the field, Warren Coleman, Lyle Blackburn, Stan Gordon, and many more. CryptidCon will be an action-packed weekend with vendors, seminars, and even a Bigfoot hunt. Go to www.cryptidcon.com for all the details.
That certainly sounds like fun, but if your tastes run a bit more towards skepticism of monsters, you might want to hear from our friends at the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry about the 2017 CSI Con.
Hi, my name is Barry Carr, and I'm here with Tom Flynn and Jim Underdown talking about the upcoming SciCon conference this October in Las Vegas. So, Tom, Jim, what are you looking forward to coming out to SciCon?
I cannot wait. I will be hosting the disco party on Saturday night, and is it a zombie disco party?
If you want to dress as a zombie, that's fine. That's what we're billing it as, a costume party, so come as you like.
Yeah, and we're actually going to have cash prizes and dancing and drinks.
Is it true that the grand prize will be a big bowl of brains?
Well, leaving the brains and the zombies aside, this is a conference with some heavyweights in the skeptical community. For instance, we have Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, James Randi, Eugenie Scott. The list actually goes on and on. We have almost 40 speakers coming or more. We have workshops, of course, entertainment, as we mentioned. Anything you particularly want to see?
My dear friend Richard Wiseman will be here, also from the UK, author of Quirkology. I can't wait to see him.
And don't forget Richard Saunders from Australia. It's going to be Richards busting out all over.
It's the richness of Richards.
It absolutely is.
I'll be gambling, too, at some point.
No, skeptics do not gamble. Skeptics don't gamble. We know the odds. We don't do that.
If my experience last year is any indication, skeptics do not gamble. Skeptics win.
I have a
Some
system.
Skeptics.
Barry, I have a system that is guaranteed to win. I'm going to grab a stack of chips and run.
Okay, the New Yorker writer Maria Konnikova is going to be receiving the Ballas Award for Critical Thinking for her most recent book.
Right, The Confidence Game. Yeah, Maria was a speaker last year. She spoke about The Confidence Game last year. This year, she's talking about her new book, which is about luck.
So what better to talk about luck?
She'll vindicate me. The Skeptical Toolbox people will be there. Ray Hyman, Jim Elcock, Harriet Hall.
And speaking of skeptics groups that are coming, we have the Skeptics Guide to the Universe. The whole crew is coming this year.
It seems a little skeptic heavy, don't you think, this conference?
This is the Skeptics Heavyweight event of the year.
It does not get better than this.
So we hope to see you there. It's October 26th through the 29th at the Excalibur Hotel. It's the one that looks like the big castle. You know, you'll see it. When you fly into the airport, you see the towers, Rapunzel's there.
It's the one that looks like the Walt Disney opium dream.
So come check us out in Las Vegas.
Wow, that sounds like a fun convention. I wish I could make it this year. I hope you can. I will be attending DragonCon in Atlanta in September, hopefully on a few panels there, and I'll post more information about that when I have the details. Don't forget there's a bit of fun horror literature discussion after the credits of this episode. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Well, here's what I need to do. I need to ask about this Stephen King pastiche question. So if you have just a second to talk about that. So there's this...
I do have a second.
All right. There's the Stephen King story.
I think it interests you maybe more than me.
So
talk about it.
Sure. Jerusalem Slot's the name of the story. It appears in Stephen King's collection of short stories called Graveyard Shift. And in our correspondence leading up to this interview with you, I mentioned that I thought that was a pastiche of Lovecraft, and you said that you didn't think so. And I wanted to talk about why you feel it's not, but I think first we may be – how do you define a Lovecraft pastiche? Because there certainly are a lot of things out there that I think fit that bill. But
that's sort of my answer and is kind of like what's behind my rejection of that label for that story. It's actually very clearly influenced by Innsmouth, obviously, because you've got this heretical, you know, schismatic Puritan sect, and you've got the New England small town, which I think is something that where dark things are happening, which obviously is something that Stephen King kind of took over to a large degree, I think, from, you know, from Lovecraft. But, you know, when I think of a pastiche, I think really very specifically of this kind of paint-by-numbers approach to Lovecraft, where there has to be discussion of, you know, three or four members of the Elder Gods pantheon, also, you know, overuse of the adjective eldritch. you know, it's eldritch, and we know it's eldritch because they keep telling us that. And, you know, tentacles and a mention of the Necronomicon and, you know, all these things. And so to me, pastiche is actually a much less sophisticated kind of influence than what I think we see in a lot of King's work that has been influenced by Lovecraft. So that's why I would avoid pastiche. There's no doubt that that story, Skeleton Crew, the novel Revival, elements of Tommyknockers and from a Buick 8. I mean, there's no question that those are heavily influenced by Lovecraft.
But this one sticks out to me. But do you see pastiche as pejorative? Is that why you avoid it?
I do see it as pejorative. I see it pejorative in part, specifically in relationship to Lovecraft, just because there were so many practitioners of it. I mentioned in the book that Derleth at one point is writing this whole series of Cthulhu stories, one of which, you know, ends with like the human race has to nuke Cthulhu in order to save themselves. And so this kind of putting together a Lovecraft story as if it's a Lego kit is kind of what I think of.
That's interesting. So the reason
I mean, pastiche really means, you know, it's essentially we're talking about cutting and pasting.
Right. Well, so but look at the elements of this one story. So I'm not saying that it's not a poor story, and I don't mean it's a mere shadow of Lovecraft's work, because I think it's transcendent, at least in as much that it picks up the tools of modern and more accessible writing and tries to construct a similar tale, because it takes place in New England. It takes place with a man coming to an ancestral home. It definitely echoes the rats in the walls with the continued noises in the walls. There's as you mentioned, there's a cult at work. There is no Necronomicon, but there is a mysterious tome, the Mysteries of the Worm. And right. The narrator is a male who works with a subordinate male.
Parallels.
Yeah, much of it is written in diary entries, and there's so much about it that seems to me like it would have been a Lovecraft story. I think if Lovecraft had that story sent to him, he'd rewrite it, stick in more eldritch, throw in some more gods' names, and you know, make a day of it. Yeah. But
which he often did. I mean, I think part of it too is, you know, I think with Stephen King especially, it's, you know, Harold Bloom's idea of kind of the anxiety of influence, too. I mean, in reading Danse Macabre, you learn that one of the things you learn is that Stephen King wants to be influenced by Lovecraft. And I think, you know, the making of his Dark Small Towns, I mean, Castle Rock and other places in New England are certainly evidence of that.
Yeah, it seems more Lovecraft than Faulkner, right? So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think maybe it's just the sour feelings that I have about the term pastiche. Just because there's so many bad examples of Lovecraft pastiche, you know, over the last 50 or 60 years.
I've contributed to that body.
I hope it came out in the book, you know, too, that like I think that Stephen King, not only because of Lovecraft's influence on him, you know, really ought to be taken, a bit more seriously by academic critics than is generally the case.
I'm sure he will. But you know what? In the meantime,
but
unlike Lovecraft, he's probably going to be okay. What?
Oh, yeah. He's fine. Although this does seem to be, this is apparently something that has always rankled him. That's maybe a discussion for another day, but yeah.
Oh, you mean the dismissal by academia?
The dismissal by academia, dismissal by sort of the critical establishment,
It's interesting.
He's got to become an old master first.
Well, I could tell you that when I was in high school, I was reading him. But when I was in college, at least one of my English professors went on and on frequently about how good the book Misery was, because not only did it tell a great story, but it talked so much about the writing process, and it was just a masterful meditation on the writing process.
That's a great book. And I think he obviously suffers too from suffers, I don't know is the word, but essentially every word that he writes makes it into print. And then if he wants to, include everything that an editor cut out, it ends up back in there, like the, 1700 page.
The Stand and the incredible volumes for The Dark Tower
which I can't even, that seems like something I would enjoy, but something I can't get my arms around the idea of it, sort of, it's become so sprawling,
Wheel of Time material type stuff. So
that was why I had that reaction to what we'll call the Jerusalem's Lot gambit.
Yeah. that's why I started with asking, because I thought before, anytime you have an argument or you feel like you have a contention, always check your terms. Make sure you're arguing about the same thing. So
that's right. A good point. Yeah.
All right.
What I take away from this is that you're wrong. What?
Leave that in. Don't edit that out.
And done. All right. Thanks again, Scott. I really appreciate
you
joining
us. Thank you, Scott. Good to chat with you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.